AgBioScience is supported by Indiana Farm Bureau.
Some of our producers are actually using agricultural grade drones to spray disinfectant on the roofs of their barns because they're concerned about those wild birds migrating and spreading virus through the environment. And so if they can disinfect barns and then the water, if it rains, doesn't collect all of that virus and then somehow get entered into that barn and into that animal population, then they have been able to avoid potential introduction. So it's simple things like that that you don't always think of.
Welcome to Ag Bioscience, the number one podcast in the world for innovation in food, animal health, plant science, ag tech, and agriculture. Here is your host, Agrinova CEO, Mitch Fraser.
Welcome back to Ag Bioscience. The U.S. Department of Agriculture calls biosecurity the cornerstone of animal livestock production. It's a cornerstone that's taken center stage of late as farmers have battled disease. One organization, one agency is the agency that can bring insight to what's happening in livestock production. And we're joined today by Dr. Kelly Werling, the director of the Animal Programs Division. First, Kelly, welcome to Ag Bioscience. And second, congratulations on your recent promotion.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and to represent the Board of Animal Health here in Indiana.
It is going to be, I think, a really important discussion, Kelly. So much attention has been paid recently to disease, biosecurity in animal livestock. Let's start there. Can you give us some perspective on what is the current state of biosecurity in animal production here in the Midwest?
It's probably of no surprise to the folks that are listening to this that certainly it has been a interesting 2025 already, and even into 2024 as it relates to kind of animal health and the status of poultry production across the nation, really, and not just here in the Midwest, but certainly we're feeling it here in Indiana because of the status of highly pathogenic avian influenza in the poultry populations, both domestic and wild. And now, of course, spreading into other species, which I imagine we'll talk about in a little bit here. Everyone has biosecurity at the forefront of their minds, as they should. It's something that I think that producers do an excellent job of thinking about and planning for. And then we have to think about how do we implement that in a practical way that's able to be sustained for an amount of time, right? So we are still currently in the most, I think, impactful animal health event as deemed by the USDA with this highly pathogenic avian influenza incident, which technically started in February of 2022. So we're 3 years in, over 3 years in, and still having to think about how do we maintain those enhanced levels of biosecurity when people are just getting tired, right? It's fatiguing to kind of have that closed fist all the time, but making sure that what we're recommending when we think about biosecurity, what can producers practically and reasonably be able to implement that makes a difference on their farm to prevent one, disease introduction, or two, if it is introduced, prevent further spread to other animal populations in that vicinity.
We've spent so much time in the macro, just as the American populace on eggs, right?
Absolutely.
There's been so many stories covering this. Maybe give us a quick update on where we are with this gap that we see at a store shelf, where it's come from. But also, this is not just unique, as you mentioned, to birds.
No, it's not. You're absolutely right. So absolutely, consumers are feeling the pressure of this high path AI, highly pathogenic avian influenza. It's a mouthful. So if I say HPAI, that's what I mean. Consumers are feeling it. It has affected each and every one of us, I think, at some level or other. From the producers, their animal populations or their poultry have been diagnosed with avian influenza, all the way to the consumers at the store standing there and there's no eggs on the shelf, or the eggs that are there are considerably more expensive than what is historically what we see. So what we're seeing, of course, is as part of the response to avian influenza in these animal populations, they do succumb to the disease if left to their own devices. And so part of the response, one, to decrease further spread of the disease, but also as an animal welfare concern for those animal populations or for those poultry populations, is to euthanize those birds. And so if there are less chickens around to lay eggs, we are starting to see the pressure of that. And consumers are seeing that on the store shelves, so to speak. So yeah, it has impacted all of us in one way or another. It's our team at the Board of Animal Health related to response activities. Our team is working very hard to try to help producers, one, prevent introduction of the disease in the first place, but two, if it does unfortunately get detected in one of our populations or our operations here in Indiana, to help that producer through those response steps and activities, and then hopefully get them back in business as soon as possible. So certainly, second part of your question there was related to this not just being a poultry problem.
Right.
So in March of 2024, this isn't really a year anniversary you want to celebrate, but just a year ago, it was detected in dairy cattle for the first time, the same highly pathogenic avian influenza virus, which is H5N1. For the virologists out there who are listening to this, for the rest of us, it's HPAI, but it's the same one circulating in wild birds that then spread it to domestic poultry, as well as now it can be detected in lots of mammalian species, things like dairy cattle. They've found it affecting cats as well. So there's many species. I only mentioned three here. And of course, poultry encompasses a lot of different species within poultry. But there's a lot of different species that have been affected by this now that we didn't know prior to about a year ago or a little over a year ago. So that makes us think about, okay, how does the virus act in those species? Because not every single species acts the same with the disease progression. It has to do with the receptors, and I won't bore you with that, but there is a scientific reason why we see different species affected differently with HIPATH AI, even though it's the same virus. And so certainly we have to expand our thought process and our strategy as we think about how would we respond to that in other species and not just in our poultry that we unfortunately are getting quite used to having detections since we've been in this same outbreak, like I said, for over 3 years, and it hasn't really let up.
Are these detections in other species? This is the first time I've heard beyond dairy cattle. Is it a function of us being able to detect it more readily now? I mean, is it an advancement of the detection technology, or is it a mutation of the virus itself that makes it more active in other species?
I think that's a great question, right? Because there are those confounding factors you don't always think about on face value.
Right.
So certainly, I think it's potentially both of those answers. So I think that H5N1, the current avian influenza that we're dealing with, has been acting just slightly different than previous strains and previous outbreaks. But that being said, I think people are also paying closer attention. And the exposure, I think, is different. There's just so much virus in the environment. And I don't say that to make people concerned about it. But there's just so much virus in the environment because the wild birds are heavily affected. So as they migrate back and forth,
sure,
they're flying over all this farmland, they're flying over cities, towns, and potentially, you know, moving avian influenza with them. So it's just the matter that I think because the viral load is just so high in the environment, we're seeing these other mammalian species, somewhat innocent bystanders, getting caught up in or contracting the disease.
You highlighted a point that I think has gone woefully underreported, and that's this idea of this heightened state of alert, the heightened state of biosecurity that producers, particularly egg producers in the poultry industry specifically, are facing, have faced for multiple years. How do you, as a regulator, as an organization who works with producers every day, how do you balance the practicality of that, the science of that, and then I have to imagine there's an emotional piece of it as well, where it just takes a toll.
Absolutely. You're 100% correct. We're really fortunate in Indiana that our producers are so innovative. So using kind of the same technologies and the same tools in the toolbox, so to speak, and applying them in different ways that are innovative and creative and still science-based, but like slightly just a different spin on it, which is really, it's been something really neat to be a part of, especially in the past, you know, I guess we'll say 4 months. It is April now. Time is a little relative when you're in the middle of HIPATH AI response. We're really fortunate. We've got very innovative producers, and they often come to us and say, hey, I've got this idea. Do you think this would work, one, from a biosecurity standpoint? Is it worth the effort? What is the trade-off and that value proposition going to be if I implement this new, unique way of implementing my biosecurity? Is it going to get us the result that we want? And does it make sense, or is it just kind of an off-the-wall idea? You know? And so we're really fortunate. We have the opportunity to talk with producers when they come to us with those types of innovative ideas and creative thinking that we don't always think of. I am not a poultry producer myself, so while I get the chance to interact with and talk with a lot, they know their operation the best. They know the ins and outs of their buildings, their production systems, the structures, things that if you're not in those environments every day, you might not always think about it. So they can come to us with their knowledge base and say, hey, I've got this idea. What do you think? And most of the time, we're very fortunate that we can say, that is really innovative. Please go for it. Let us know how it works. So we can either share that information with other folks as a strategy to, for implementation of biosecurity on their sites, or we can say, hey, this company or something tried this and then didn't quite work on the value proposition side. So we do try to think through and think about, like, all ships should rise, right? So anything that we learn and can then share, assuming it's nothing proprietary that couldn't be shared, because we're very careful with that type of information. We certainly want to be able to try to be a part of the solution and are fortunate, but you're absolutely right. It does take an emotional toll on people. Sometimes one barn might be affected, but all birds have to be euthanized. And so it can be very hard to have to euthanize birds that are apparently healthy one day, but could definitely be sick the next. But you don't know, because you have euthanized that population to prevent the humane issues of letting those birds just succumb to disease on their own, or potential transmission off the site because birds are just staying on the landscape and could be incubating virus or shedding virus. So it is difficult. And we certainly have partnered with other folks around the state to try to provide some mental health resources to our producers. You know, Purdue Extension Farm Stress, we certainly have talked with them. The Purdue College of Veterinary Medicine also has a veterinary social worker who has given out her phone number to folks that we can allow them to talk, so they can kind of just kind of debrief on their feelings and the situation and how they can take this situation and kind of, you know, come out on the other side. We've also very much utilized, the American Association of Swine Veterinarians has created a depopulation debriefing tool or a resiliency tool. It's kind of a check-in for yourself after you've been through kind of this type of response to, I don't know, just kind of break down, you know, what you're feeling. Also, not just the negative feelings, but like, what was something that made you laugh today? You know, just those types of things to kind of also remember that, like, we are all human. And this can be pretty impactful on the mental health side, as well as on people's, you know, economic and physical health, because all of those things are certainly connected.
Powerful story. I love the focus on innovation. We're going to dig into what that innovation looks like and what it could mean for the future of animal health. We'll do it right after this. Ag Bioscience is supported by Indiana Farm Bureau.
From berries to dairies, from crop advisors to data analyzers, Indiana Farm Bureau is at the forefront of the top issues impacting Indiana agriculture. No matter your role in the ag industry, Indiana Farm Bureau membership means you'll always have a champion and an advisor. And because so much of your time is focused on your own enterprise, it's also good to know Indiana Farm Bureau is always working to fight for the future of agriculture. We come together to advocate for rural viability, the protection of property rights, competitive tax policies, and against burdensome regulations. Whether our members need a door opened, an impact in public policy, or an ally to strengthen their communities, Indiana Farm Bureau is there. We are the unified voice for all agriculture. To learn more about the benefits of Indiana Farm Bureau membership, go to infb.org.
Welcome back to Ag Bioscience, talking with Dr. Kelly Werling, Director of Animal Programs at the Indiana Board of Animal Health. Kelly, we have been talking about this challenge, the requirement for biosecurity, but also the challenge the current environment presents. You highlighted innovation and the ways in which producers are finding new solutions. When you look at innovation in biosecurity, help us understand the landscape. Is it pharmaceutical? Is it physical? Where are you seeing the innovations emerge?
I think it's a little bit of all of that, actually. So when we think about biosecurity, we think about three tiers, essentially. And I won't get into too academic, I hope, but this does answer your question. We'll get there, I promise. So one of them is kind of the conceptual biosecurity, right? So thinking about things like, where do you site your operations? So some of that is out of our control because those operations have existed for a long time. You can't just re-site them. They exist. And there may be other operations in the area. But if you're putting in a new site, thinking about that. That one's a little bit less on the innovation side, but more on the what can you control related to just being in proximity of other operations. The next thing is structural. So we think about structural biosecurity. What types of structures can we put into place to help us in that effort, right? It's as simple as like having gated entry to your farm location, right? So that you have some sort of traffic control. You just don't have people coming on and off that are unauthorized to do so. It's also things like thinking about ventilation systems. So when you're building sites, building a facility, tunnel ventilation, forced air ventilation, any of those different things that you can do to prevent disease from being pulled into and concentrated into a barn. And then lastly is the procedural one. And this is the one I think we see the most innovation in. Specifically, those are the actual actions that we do and how we actually implement biosecurity on sites. So that's things like, this is an innovative way to apply a disinfectant on a farm. Some of our producers are actually using agricultural grade drones to spray disinfectant on the roofs of their barns because they're concerned about those wild birds migrating and spreading virus through the environment. And so if they can disinfect barns and then the water, if it rains, doesn't collect all of that virus and then somehow get entered into that barn and into that animal population, then they have been able to avoid potential introduction. So it's simple things like that that you don't always think of. So it's not necessarily that it's an innovative product, but it's two things that already exist. We already have effective disinfectants. We already have kind of those agricultural drones and those aerial ways of applying different product and marrying those two things together in a way that is all innovation by the producers and the farmers in the fields that think, if I want to prevent virus from getting into my operation, what can I do and what do I have to be able to do that? So that's just one example that comes to top of mind. There's certainly others out there, but it does come down to those procedural things that we do. It does also come down to, you mentioned pharmaceuticals, it does also come down to the tools that we have in the toolbox, right? And there is innovation happening there, especially as it relates to, not limited to, but as it relates to vaccine production. So I know there are a lot of schools of thought as it relates to vaccines. But some of, you know, prior to last year, not knowing that dairy cattle could be infected with highly pathogenic avian influenza, there was no vaccine for that species. So research is being done to create one and then figure out what the use case scenario might be for that particular instance. So just a couple examples to kind of talk about that innovation piece. There's a lot of research happening related to avian influenza right now. There's been a lot of information come out of that research. And then there's certainly more for us to learn as they continue on down that path. But I think that at some point we'll be able to see what some of that research is and how we can actually apply it in that biosecurity space.
You look at biosecurity and I think you've shared this or versions of this, that the best defense, right, is a good offense and being really thoughtful about how do we tackle everything within the operation? I love the idea that necessity is the mother of all invention, right? Like what you just walked through is like, yes, that's how it should work. When you think of this, having a strong offense to present a good defense in biosecurity, what are the two or three things that you're telling producers today to prioritize?
The best defense is the best offense, right?
Right, that's right.
Did I get that right?
Yes.
Either one works. Sorry
either
about
one
that.
I think could be applicable here, right?
I agree with you is what I'm trying to say. I think if I had to pinpoint two or three main things when we're talking about biosecurity and what producers can really do, it is like what you said. It's thinking strategically, really taking a thorough assessment of their on-site biosecurity, right? Every farm, every operation is different. Could be laid out differently. It could be procedurally different. There's just so many variables that need to be taken into account. And being able to do that very site-specific assessment is one of the things. So I would say if folks have not had the chance to do that, I think at this point, many have thought about it, but certainly taking the time to think through what that looks like for them individually on farm. And then, of course, if they have multiple sites, to apply that to every single operation that they might be a part of or have some stake in. The next thing I would say is then to plan for the worst, which is never a fun topic to think about, but sometimes the worst does happen. And so how do we make a difficult situation the least impactful as possible on a negative standpoint, right? So we want to have the least amount of negative impact as possible. And planning ahead is really how we can accomplish that. And by planning ahead, I specifically mean for farmers to think about, right? Like things we haven't thought about that we've been having to think about now in this current outbreak with HiPath AI is, this is a fun topic to talk about, manure management, right?
Sure.
So you don't, and maybe you do, I don't personally think about all the manure on a site at any given point, at any day, at any time. But the day that AI is diagnosed, we have to think about what to do with all that manure. And it actually becomes more of a disposal issue, really, than the management of the disease sometimes, depending on the production system, how much storage was on site. And now we have to figure out what to do with that product, so to speak. And so just things like that, thinking about, okay, if I needed to wait this out because I couldn't move the manure off, what would that mean for my operation? Better yet, what can I do to think of a unique and potentially innovative disposal solution that is still going to be disposal in a biosecure manner that we're not moving AI around the place when we're trying to dispose of material like that. So I get to talk about a lot of fun things in my job, be it manure or other less exciting topics, I guess. But so that's one of the main things I hope people think about when they think about biosecurity. The third thing, and I will probably just leave it at this, is really considering like what is practical to be implemented on site. So we can talk about the ideal best biosecurity ever in theory. But if it's not implemented and actually practiced, it doesn't do what it's supposed to do. And it doesn't, you know, prevent either disease introduction or transmission. And so we don't want the best written plan that no one actually implements. We want a really good plan that's actually able to be carried out on site and that farmers can actually follow and not make it so burdensome that they aren't able to keep up with that level of biosecurity. So that would be my final point, is just making sure that it is something that is practical and able to be well implemented on site, so that it meets the desire and the goal of all of this, which is actually having good biosecurity. It's not just to have a good plan, but actually be able to implement that plan.
Implement a plan as part of the business, not a separate thing. It is the business, and making sure that it can still be a business and generate net income, build the business going forward. Kelly, we've talked about a lot. We probably have time for one more question. This one I think is important as people begin to look to the second half of the year, dare I say, start to look to 2026. What can we expect ahead in 25? Any things that are on your horizon, things that you're looking at?
I think we can expect to see similar disease pressure. I think that it hasn't gone away in the past 3 years, and I don't know that it's going to go away in the short term here. But I do think that on the horizon are maybe some potentially different ways to approach the current response to specifically AI, but certainly this could be applied to other animal health related issues as well. Like I mentioned before, there's a lot of research ongoing into this specific topic. And so I think we're going to see what that's going to look like into the future from those learnings. How do we apply that in unique and innovative ways? I think also that there's, of course, going to be some pressure as it relates to our political climate. We don't have to go into politics, but certainly thinking about the tariff issues, I think producers are probably going to see that also be impactful. But to go back to the animal health side, I think that what we've been able to do here in Indiana, and I know it's happening across the nation and other states too, is to take a very critical look at what some of our response activities are, especially in this current outbreak, and try to find creative and unique ways to rethink some of those activities, right? So one example is previously we would have to dispose of like literally every egg on site if it was an egg facility that was diagnosed or detected with high path AI. And so now, because of the pressure that everyone is seeing all the way to the grocery store and our consumers, we're trying to think of ways that we can feel very confident and still, of course, have public health and food safety top of mind to not have to just throw all that product away and try to think of innovative and creative ways to find solutions so that there's a little less pressure also on that consumer end. And that's only one example, but everything that we've done or are looking to do into the future, making sure the science is sound, making sure public health and human safety is still utmost of mind, but then also trying to figure out, is there a better or different way to maybe approach the problem just because of the magnitude of the incident that we're in and the longevity in which we find ourselves? It isn't going away, so we may have to think of creative and unique ways to approach it.
The power of innovation. Kelly, my hope is we get a chance to talk about this on the other side and look back on what this innovation has done for this industry. Thanks so much. She's Dr. Kelly Werling, Director of Animal Programs at the Indiana Board of Animal Health. Kelly, thanks again for joining us on Ag Bioscience. And thank you for joining us. You can always get the latest Ag Bioscience news and insights from discussions just like this by subscribing wherever you get your podcast. Don't forget, while you're online, you can check us out at agrinovusindiana.com. On behalf of the entire Agrinovus team, I'm Mitch Frazier. Sam, thanks for joining us. We look forward to seeing you real soon.
Ag Bioscience is a podcast by Agrinovus Indiana, hosted by Mitch Frazier, produced by Kayla Chittister and Fabian Rodriguez, photography and design by Kaylee Kerr. If you like today's episode, subscribe, rate, and review so we can bring you more conversations just like this. Get all episodes of Ag Bioscience at agrinovusindiana.com.